When you're at the grocery store, in the meat aisle, it looks like you've got plenty of choices. But according to our next guest, you probably have fewer choices than what you think. He says America's meat industry is taken over by a handful of corporations, including the giant of the industry, Tyson.
Because of that control, Tyson can drive up prices while pushing their farmers to the edge of bankruptcy, according to our guest. He says America's meat industry is now an oligarchy that controls most of the food we eat, and it's completely rigged against us.
Joining us now is Christopher Leonard. He's a fellow with the New America Foundation and former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business. Christopher, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you call the meat industry in America today the biggest takeover in American business that you've never heard of. Why has the story slipped under the radar for so long?
Well, I think there are a few reasons, but maybe one of the most important ones is that the companies at the center of this book, like Tyson Foods or Smithfield Foods, are really anchored out in rural communities in the Midwest, especially in Southeast, that really don't get visited by the national press a lot. I've been a business reporter for over 10 years, and I can tell you that most of the focus of the business press is on Wall Street and the stock market and all of this. And some really fundamental and really important changes in the meat industry have gone largely unnoticed because they've happened so far away from the consumer's view.
But you, when you visited some of these towns, I guess you could call them kind of Tyson towns, at least the way you paint them, that the Tyson company sort of props up the entire town and all of the people who live and work there. Can you talk about one of them?
Absolutely. This book really started for me in 2004. I was a business reporter starting to write about the industrial meat system, and I went down to this little town called Waldron, Arkansas. And it is exactly what you described. I would call it a Tyson Foods town. There's an enormous Tyson Foods poultry complex on the north side of town, just a tremendous industrial facility that covers many acres. And what's interesting about it is that the way the modern meat system works today, this meat facility that Tyson owns has incorporated into it all of the businesses that used to be independently owned businesses on downtown Main Street. The Tyson plant will have a large slaughterhouse. It will have a feed mill. It will have a hatchery. It has its own trucking line to take birds out to far-flung farms around the city. So the Tyson plant was really the economic pillar of this town. But what struck me the most was just how much power Tyson had in this area. I had gone there to write about chicken farmers that were having some really serious problems on these large industrial chicken farms, and it just struck me how truly powerless these farmers were. I'm sure you've interviewed farmers before. I mean, they're typically a very entrepreneurial, independent, strong-willed lot, but these people I met outside Waldron, Arkansas were literally afraid to talk about this company, even in the safety of their own living room. Neighbors were afraid that their neighbors would find out that they'd been speaking with a reporter. And this power structure really struck me, and it's what set me off the path of investigating this company and how the modern meat industry really works.
I want to answer the question of why Tyson matters so much. And part of the answer to that is just how pervasive they seem to be in the food industry in the entire country. Can you paint a picture of how wide Tyson's reach is, where their products show up?
Absolutely. And that is a key reason why this company is so important. First of all, Tyson is not a chicken company. It's the biggest producer and one of the biggest in all three major meats. It makes chicken, beef, and pork. And basically, it makes 1 out of 5 pounds of all the meat consumed in the United States. You can walk through the meat aisle of a modern grocery store and just see a rainbow of product names. For different, I mean, everything from pepperoni to chicken pot pie to the rotisserie chicken in the case that's unlabeled. But Tyson Foods makes all of these. And it's the same story for other companies like Smithfield or Cargill. We saw a massive wave of consolidation happen in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, so that all these independent companies have been bought up by the big four, and now all these separate brand names really can all be traced back to just four companies, which narrows consumers' choice. But I'd also like to say Tyson is so important, not just because of its size and scale and its reach across the market, but because Tyson really pioneered the modern method of meat production, the industrial, very tightly integrated form of meat production. Tyson was on the forefront of it and has been driving some of these changes in the meat business.
Is that another word for factory farming?
Yes, it is. Chickens were the first animals to be factory farmed. I call them the industrial animal. They were sort of the perfect animal to be raised along an assembly line, if you will. I mean, literally, egg-laying hens drop their eggs onto a conveyor belt. The eggs are sent to a giant hatchery where the eggs are agitated on trays, and then the chicks are sent out to farms to be raised. It is like a factory system. But a key element of this, again, is the integration, the fact that you've got one company controlling all the aspects of production. That was a critical part of this formula.
So part of the problem, as you painted in the book, is that because there's so little diversity in meat suppliers in the country, the business practice that Tyson uses go on to become the industry standard. And, for instance, you talk about how Tyson used an antibiotic to increase, or maybe it was an antibiotic, a drug to increase growth in an animal, and that became the norm. Everyone had to do it to keep up.
Yes, and it was a pretty amazing story. It was actually a growth drug called Zilmax that was originally developed for asthma in humans. And somebody figured out that if you fed this drug to cattle, it would make them swell up with muscle. I mean, really pack the pounds on. But it was also found through several studies that it created steaks that were of a lower quality. Well, the advantage to using a drug like Zilmax for a big meat packer like Tyson is that you get more pounds of meat for every cow that goes in the front door of that slaughterhouse. So Tyson began quietly encouraging its contract feedlot owners to use Zilmax. Now, I'd like to pause there for a second. We're talking about the chicken model of raising meat being applied now to hog production and even cattle production. This sort of model, again, where a company controls the aspects of production and farmers raise animals under contract. Tyson has built up a network of feedlots that it operates. It does business with under contract, if you will. The cattle are never sold on an open market. They're given to Tyson under contract. And because there's that kind of arrangement, Tyson could quickly spread the use of this drug Zilmax, which is exactly what happened. And it beefed up its cattle. And then other big meat packers like Cargill were pressured into doing the same thing. I mean, Cargill publicly was saying, we don't want to use this drug Zilmax because it creates lower quality steak and consumers are going to turn away from beef. But there was so much pressure because Tyson was using this that the other companies fell in line. Now, eventually, really grave concerns about animal welfare started coming up last year about Zilmax and the cattle that were fed Zilmax. And Tyson canceled its use of that drug and other companies followed suit quickly. But I just think it was very telling that this sort of obscure and controversial drug became the industry standard for raising cattle quietly and quickly because the consolidation has happened so massively in this business.
I know you're looking at the big picture here with Tyson, but I want to stop and tell another story from your book. In terms of quality control and health of the animals and people who subsequently eat their meat, you tell a story about a woman who's raising chickens for Tyson, and they contract some kind of mysterious illness, which is sort of horrifyingly described in your book. And it seems as though lots of other farmers have chickens with this issue, and the Tyson people show up in sort of blue hazmat suits. Can you tell that story and what it might imply about safety in food?
Absolutely. When I mentioned earlier that I went down to this town of Waldron, Arkansas, that was exactly the story I was sent there to cover. These farmers, incidentally, these people that own factory farms, like the woman you just mentioned, Kenita Yandell, one of the sources for that chapter of the book, here's how it works. A farmer like that will borrow maybe hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars to build a large industrial complex of modern-day chicken houses. And then they sign a contract with Tyson Foods. And Tyson Foods will then deliver birds to the farm, deliver feed to the farm, send field techs to the farm. And the farmer basically raises the birds for Tyson, and Tyson comes and picks them up when it's time for slaughter. Farmer never owns the most important asset on the farm. They never own the chicken itself. That can be a very problematic situation, as we can see with Jerry and Kennedy Yandell. In 2003, the Yandells and other farmers around Waldron started getting these shipments of birds that were obviously profoundly sick. They had some kind of horrible disease. They started dying the instant they were delivered. I mean, I don't want to gross out your listeners, but the birds were basically like falling apart while they were still alive. And this poor couple, Jerry and Kenita Yandell, couldn't get answers from Tyson Foods. They were saying, what is the matter with these birds? What's going wrong? And they never got a straight answer out of the company. And this couple, who had worked for over 25 years to build their family chicken farm, they were driven out of business in a matter of just a few months, because they got three consecutive flocks of birds with this disease, and the birds were wiped out, so the farmers lost money, but they still had to pay these massive mortgage payments on their farms. And it was remarkable to me that these farmers are kept so close to the edge of bankruptcy that it only took three bad flocks of birds to destroy this family's farm. And, you know, Jerry and Kenita are not some isolated case. They're not the people who got the one bad apple out of a very large bunch of good apples. They are absolutely indicative of cases you see in chicken farmers around the country. The evidence that this is widespread is found in courthouses throughout rural America, enforcement actions by the USDA, newspaper stories everywhere.
We're talking right now with Christopher Leonard, who says the meat industry has been taken over by a handful of corporations. We've been talking about one of the biggest, Tyson Foods, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Have business practices in the meat industry put you off from eating meat, or do you think this is the cost of having affordable meat on the table? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Christopher Leonard. He's the author of The Meat Racket, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Wondering what you think about the way meat has been consolidated, the production of meat in America, and whether you think it's worth it to have affordable meat on people's tables. Our number, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And I want to ask you that question about what Tyson is doing. They have consolidated, and they are one of the food giants in America. But presumably, part of what they're doing is delivering what consumers want, and this is a variety of affordable products that people can fit into their budget. What's wrong with that?
Well, I think that was the case for many years, but is no longer the case. And that's not the conclusion that I thought would be the case when I started reporting the book, but all the evidence supports it. This is a really old situation in economics. When too few companies get too much control over a market, they do a very simple thing. They depress what they pay for goods. In Tyson's case, it depresses what it pays farmers to raise meat. And then they turn around and they can manipulate the market in a way that raises the prices they can charge for a product. It keeps prices higher for consumers. Now, when we industrialized the meat system in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, it made meat cheaper. We got great efficiencies of scale. The system was really streamlined. There were lots of savings that happened, and you saw the cost of meat go down. But something really interesting started to happen in the late 1990s. That cost curve flattened out, and now it's starting to rise, and even rise sharply. I'm sure all of your listeners can relate to the fact that meat has been getting more expensive since about 2007. For some periods, it's been getting sharply more expensive with double-digit price increases. And that points to a fundamental problem of consolidation. When you let, again, too few companies get control of the market, they will tend to exercise the market power they have to raise prices. So this is exactly what we're seeing with these giant meat companies, and I will just give one example. Tyson Foods today, a single company, controls about 22% of the entire national chicken market. That's unprecedented in U.S. history. What Tyson can do and what it has done, and they've said this on the record, it's all in the book, they cut back on production, they cut back supplies when prices get low. That keeps production off the market and makes prices rise again. poultry companies back in the 80s didn't have enough market power to do this, but doing it has become central to Tyson Foods' playbook today, and it's also central to the playbook of Tyson's one big competitor, Pilgrim's Pride. Together, Tyson's and Pilgrim's Pride control over 40% of the U.S. chicken market, or right at 40% of the national chicken market. So if just two companies decide to cut supply, as they often do, then it can raise the price of chicken for consumers, and that's exactly what's been happening over the last few years.
I want to get our callers in on this. Let's go to Sandy, who's joining us in Algoma. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Hey, you know what? We really, up in Kewaunee County here, we kind of live in the middle of the situation that this gentleman's talking about. We have lots of these concentrated animal feeding operations up here, and they're making a mess of things. So we have learned the hard way about the serious cost that's affiliated with growing animals in lots of animals in a small amount of space. As a result, a lot of us have learned things that we would never have believed, that these animals are given to eat, that the way that they're treated. And I know that personally, we no longer buy any store-bought meat. We buy it from our neighbors who we know how the animal is grown, how it's treated, and how it's butchered. And the majority of the people that I now know in this area, they're the same way.
Okay, thank you so much for calling, Sandy. Does Sandy represent, do you think, a tipping of the consumer tide where people want to be more sort of up close and personal with the meat they're buying?
Well, that definitely is happening. And there is a lot more of this. It's kind of called maybe the locavore movement, if you want to use a catchphrase. But I hear it all the time. More and more people are doing exactly what Sandy's doing and buying meat from these entrepreneurial farmers who will sell maybe a quarter of a cow, if you will, at a time, or a batch of chickens at a time. And it's an exciting market. And it's a very good thing for rural entrepreneurs who want to get into this business and raise animals that way. I do kind of want to point out that it is today a small part of the market, that the industrial system delivers over 90% of the meat to U.S. citizens. So it's really important that we take a hard look at this system and how it works and how much consolidation we want to allow, instead of maybe just hoping that, you know, consumers will be able to steer their money toward local producers.
Let's go to another phone call now. Scott joins us in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Scott.
Hello. How you doing?
Okay.
Very interesting. I actually do free-range chickens. Every year we run, I have a system where we run them in grass and stuff. And the problem I'm having is access to certified or state-inspected processors. I could sell multiple times more. It's just a matter of, I have to haul them 40-some miles right now. And I think if you gave the public the option and you had facilities or somehow got it going, I think the problem would solve itself. I don't think educated people know the difference. And I'm getting $3.45 a pound for my bird. So we're talking 7-pound birds sometimes. It's a big investment, but I have no problem selling out. So, you know, I think the local thing is more than just a trend. I think people are like this show is pointing out and stuff like that. But, to me, it's a matter of, you know, letting me accomplish what I want, and then more of us will come along.
All right. Thank you, Scott. And Christopher, one thing I want to ask you is about challengers to Tyson. You have small guys, small outfits like Scott, who aren't really going to be a threat to Tyson. Are there challenges to this sort of method of producing meat?
Scott brings up this critical point. I mean, what he's talking about is a huge problem. I hear it all the time. The big meat packers and the American Meat Institute, they're well-funded lobbyists here in Washington. They always want to talk about, oh my goodness, the meat industry is so heavily regulated. And that's true. I mean, there are USDA food safety inspectors at every major mega Tyson Foods plant in the country and plants for the other companies. But these regulations are written in a way that go hand in glove with the interest of the big meat packers. And Scott is pointing to a perfect example of this. The way the USDA food safety regulations are structured now, it acts as a barrier to competition. The fact that you need to slaughter at a large concentrated mega plant to make it work, and you know, someone like Scott is having to ship his birds 40 miles to get a, you know, approved inspection, that keeps out competitors. And that's just one element of a lot of factors that right now create an incredibly high barrier to competition. And, you know, chapter 12 of the book, I talk about the economic crisis of 2008, which created a real moment of opportunity that entrepreneurs could have jumped in. And I'm not talking about small producers. I'm talking about big producers, maybe someone who'd want to invest $25, $50 million to build a poultry plant. But even in that moment, the big players were able to edge out and squeeze out and suffocate new competitors and make sure that nobody could get into the business. So I think it's a market today where there's entrepreneurial spirit and interest, but a very, very high barrier to entry.
Now, in our last minute here, Christopher, when he got into office, President Obama launched an attempt to reform the meat industry in about 2010. He brought on Tom Vilsack to take on the concentration of power that you're talking about in the agricultural industry, that the meat industry in particular. Could you talk about why that failed?
Yes, I can. I mean, they proposed a very sweeping set of antitrust reforms. Would have been the most sweeping since the Great Depression. Basically, what happened is what has happened several times in the past. The meat industry lobbyists in Washington, very, very, very well-funded group that has a lot of money to pass around Congress, this group kicked into action and just started killing these reforms by death with a thousand cuts. I won't get into it in detail. It's all in the book. But essentially, in just 1 year, they turned the tide on this, and the Obama administration began to retreat on its own efforts to pass antitrust laws, while at the same time, the meat industry's allies in Congress started to fight it and defund certain measures, and ultimately, the effort collapsed. But I think that there's a critical element that was missing. Addressing these problems is not rocket science. There's a great book out right now called The Bully Pulpit by Doris Kearns Goodwin. It recounts the presidency of Teddy Roosevelt, and the situation he faced back then was very similar to what we have now, giant corporations stifling economic growth, and they passed reforms to bust up the trusts. You just need willpower to do it.
Christopher, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for the time.
Christopher Leonard is a fellow with the New America Foundation and former national agribusiness reporter for the Associated Press. His new book is called The Meat Racket, The Secret Takeover of America's Food Business.